Looking to step up your Mother's Day flowers? The Home Depot has an idea. Let Mom's Green Thumb do some digging with colorful flowers, pots, and premium soils to bring out the most in her patios, walkways, and gardens. Right now, get Vigoro Potting Soil just $8.97 for strong, healthy, vibrant plants, indoors and outside. Shop our wide selection online and pick up your order in-store and give Mom the gift of a beautiful garden. Get Vigoro Potting Soil just $8.97 at the Home Depot. How doers get more done. See homedepot.com/delivery for details.
Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Scrum Down NBC Sports Rugby Podcast. I am your host with the most, Alex Kubasaran. It is great to be back, everyone. Lots to talk about, as always, coming off a sizzling Champions Cup final on the weekend that saw La Rochelle produce an incredible comeback, 17-0 down at one point to win it by a point. The game had drama, it had off-field antics going on in the change room, the intensity, the atmosphere. It really was a great spectacle for rugby and something to be proud of. We're not going to go into too much detail on it, as most pods earlier in the week have covered it, wrapped it up, and we feel it's been done just, and we don't actually have it here on NBC Sports. We're actually going to take more time focusing ahead to this weekend's Premiership final, which is on CNBC and live on Peacock TV in America, and also on demand if you want to catch it up later, anytime, any place. But for here, we have Ross Hamilton returning to preview that, to go through the numbers, to give us that insight, some really good Ford Farrell head-to-head stats as well in there. And then the bulk of this episode is going to continue our coverage of the London Irish situation. It is still ongoing, still developing. At the moment, the deadline of May 30th is still looming with no real updates or progress being announced. To continue that, to ask questions, to give some insight, as I can see on social media, fans are struggling with no one giving them sort of any updates or answers. Silence from all parties. I can only imagine players and staff in an also very frustrating situation. So to cover that, to give those fans some insight and also do this story justice, because I do feel it's an important one that hasn't been getting enough coverage. I'd rather this pod be different and not a carbon copy of every other pod. We're going to sit down with Alex Lowe and break into it. Before we get into that, we're going to do a quick Premiership final preview with Ross Hamilton. And we are joined by returning Ross Hamilton, performance analyst. Welcome back to the pod, mate. We obviously broke down the semi-finals from Premiership Rugby on last week's show. This week, we're going to preview the final, as it's the big one at Twickenham on Saturday. Welcome to the pod, mate. And I'm sure you're buzzing for this one.
Thank you, man. I am. Last one of the season. Huge game. Two of the best teams. The two best teams in a Premiership. It's great to see them in a final. And I think we're in for a cracker. Two very different teams, which I love that contest when you get two different styles of coming together to play. It's great to see that's how rugby can be played in whatever way that suits those teams. And it's brilliant to see how they contrast each other.
And let's get into the contrast. So how are these two teams going to line up? Both very strong defensively. I think the X factor that people talk about is potentially Sarri's output in attack. But Sale, when they get on the front foot, look very dangerous. And they got some serious power pieces and George Ford to pull the strings. What do you make of this one?
Yeah, look, they do it differently. You're right. So Sale's defense is the best in the league. Sarri's probably second best. Saracen's attack probably somewhat better than Sale's. That may be the edge. But Sale have an attack that suits them, that works for them, and they execute it really well. One thing I've seen for Sale, which I think is amazing, I think it's a really big nod to Alex Anderson. So having had some experience at Saracens, I know how they do things, but then knowing how Al took it from Sarri's into Sale, and just what a great coach he was when I was around him and what he is now. So what I mean by that is Sale have scored the most tries from lineouts. They score the most tries on the first phase. But what they also do is concede the fewest tries from lineouts and concede the fewest tries from the first phase. Now, from my experience and looking at stats and numbers of all these teams, to be so good on both sides of the ball like that is really, really tough. And I never seen it before, that extreme. Corbs, you'll attest to this, that again, when I've been at Saracens, when you go into camps and stuff and coaching, they're so well drilled at the blocks that they have available for different elements of the game, for attack, for defence, for line out, and so on. And it's very, very limited. So for Al to go into a sale team and get them to be so good in attack, in their line out and first phase attack, and in defence, that's huge. You usually see a sort of a yielding of one or the other, depending on their strengths and weaknesses. To be so good in both is amazing. And I think that's going to be huge because Sale's defense will stop Saracens straight up. It won't give them perhaps the platform that they're perhaps used to. And it's just a case of whether then Saracens resort to their little bit of a change of plan this year in terms of playing from further out. We mentioned this in the Northampton semi-final build-up, that they actually scored the second most tries from outside the 22. They're much more willing to play into broken play when the defense is transitioning. So it's maybe whether a case that they can manipulate themselves, Saracens, this is, around Sale's defence. But just as a contrast, straight off the back, I thought that was really interesting. And a big nod to Alex Anderson.
No, indeed. And I think that's what's exciting about this is, are you expecting Saracens to potentially kick a little bit more to try and play their way around the Sale defence? Is that what I'm inferring from that?
Quite possibly. Or potentially take their opportunities away from where Sale are strong. So what we might typically associate with the Saracens is getting into the 22, setting up a line out, getting their power game going. Sale are so good at that in defence, at defending that, they might just think we're going to avoid that completely and actually will be a little bit more open than we might think of the Saracens. They have done that better this year. If we sort of go into their attack comparisons, now once you get to the final metrics of tries and points, they're not that far away from each other. Saracens have scored the most points in the competition as an average per game, so even taking in the semi-final as well, and Sale a third. So they score their points, they just do it very differently. And a big note of that is that Sale have the lowest possession time. They average the lowest possession time of any team in the competition this year. That means they have very few carries, the second fewest. They don't get their output from keeping the ball in hand and playing with it. They kick the ball away, second most kicks behind Leicester, but get into the right areas. And that's where their tries from lineouts come into play and their tries on the first phase. They just manipulate themselves around the pitch until they're in the right areas to go. Saracens, much more willing to play. Now, they overtook Northampton in the semi-final to make the most line breaks per game on average. They averaged 10.1 per game. Second most defenders beaten, third most meters, fourth most post-contact meters, fourth most gain line success and collision success. So their output ball in hand is huge. And that gets them their return. They actually kick far fewer than Sale do. I'm just looking at numbers here. Nearly five times per game less than Sale. So Sale are sort of overtaking them in that area. Saracens much more willing to play. And it's whether that attack from Saracens can overpower what is an incredibly powerful Sale defence.
Fascinating stuff. And I think one of the big headlines that people have been talking about this weekend is Ford and Farrell. Head-to-head, childhood friends, a million partnerships together, competed for Tens jerseys, played last year in the Premiership final against each other with George Ford's team winning. Obviously, he came off earlier in that day. But, you know, have you got any numbers or stats or insight for those two matching up together?
Yeah, two huge characters, right? Two huge leaders for their team are going to be highly influential for who wins. One of the big things I see about them, and I do this for every 10 in the competition that we go through throughout the season, and when I see some of the younger 10s who come in, they are very gung-ho typically, and you see it in the stats where they take on a lot themselves. They end up carrying a lot. They end up getting stuck. They don't distribute out to their respective backlines quite so much. When you've got these two guys who are the two most experienced guys, probably the two top guys in England for a long, long time, and certainly at fly half, their balance in their play is incredible. And what I've seen from this, which is amazing, is they're almost identical. Regardless as well how Saracens have been playing and how Sale play in different ways, their game style is almost the same. So I have a look at something we call a run-kick-pass ratio, just to see the distribution of the tens and what they're trying to do, how they play with the ball. Now, they basically run exactly the same amount, 14% of the time they run, both of them, and there's a slight difference of 5% between how much they pass and kick. So in all of their kicks and passes, all of the time they have the ball in the hand, just a 5% difference with George Ford kicking a little bit more as Sale do. The other thing I then looked at was their kicking styles and what and how they apply that. So we might think, again, two teams kick slightly differently, Sale a little bit more, but their kicking styles in terms of the type of kick they do. So we break that down into a defensive kick for territory, and there are some sort of an attacking kicks for bombs up to compete high in the air, crossfield, a grubber, and a little chip over the top. They have a 1% difference in just one of their categories. So George Ford kicks for a bomb 25%, Owen Fowle 24%, and then the other difference of that is then the grubber kicks, which are 1% difference the other way. So all of the kicks that they have throughout the season, all of the times that they have the ball in play, ball in their hands, just like a 1% difference in their kick styles is incredible. And it just shows how composed, how balanced, how well they know the game, how much they want to link into their other teammates around them. It's not about them. It's not about their show. Neither of them are the best runners of the ball. They're not going to make breaks like a Marcus Smith might. But what they do with the teams around them and their players and bringing them into the game, making multiple threats, the defender keeps guessing, that's huge.
That's awesome insight, mate. And, you know, the next thing I wanted to ask you about is on, you know, before the semifinals, you sort of made predictions based on the numbers, gave an account of how you thought it was going to go, and they were pretty accurate. Looking at this final, what do you think, who gets the better of it by the numbers and any sort of hints of how you see it playing out?
Yes, we touched this briefly at the start, where both defenses are very good, with Sale slightly better. For me, Saracen's attack is significantly better than Sale's attack, so that they might be able to outpower their defense. So we know that Sale have the most dominant tackles in the competition. They concede the fewest points and tries typically in the competition. But Saracens, I think, just have enough for me in attack to outweigh their defense in that regard. And it's particularly coming down to the red zone. We talk about this quite a lot, the efficiency in the red zone, when they get into those right areas, how well are teams adapted to stopping their opposition scoring or scoring themselves. And Saracens have the fourth best efficiency in the competition. It actually gives them the second most points overall because they have so many entries as well. Sale are ninth in their efficiency. So only two teams actually come away with fewer points than they do in the entire competition. Now this team's in the final. So you think that doesn't quite stack up. It's their defense that's got them to that point, that they don't need to score that many points to outweigh their defense, what they concede. But I think that's going to be different against Saracens. I think Saracens are going to score too many points. Their attack's going to overwhelm their defense enough so that Sale will have to attack and they'll have to take their chances a bit more. Haven't really seen that throughout the entire season. Even in the semi-final, they restricted Leicester. That's how they won that semi-final. And I don't think they're going to be able to do the same. I think Saracens are going to have just a little bit too much.
Fascinating stuff, mate. Appreciate that. Great insight. We'll see if it plays out. And just again, thank you for all your contributions on this season with the Scrum Down. You've brought so much value. I know the listeners appreciate it. I see the comments on social too. So thanks again for everything, mate.
Pleasure, mate. Thanks for having me.
Always great to have Ross on, and just a huge thank you for his contribution to this pod this season and all the help he does as well with us at NBC Sports with the stats and the behind the scenes work that he produces that helped me do my job out on TV to such a higher degree because of the work and the assistance he gives me. So thanks again, Ross, and a great interview. And now it's time to transition to Alex Lowe and London Irish. And we are joined again by returning Alex Lowe, as sadly, Alex, we're still in a bit of limbo with this London Irish situation. And obviously going to talk a little bit about the Prem final today as well. But welcome back to the pod, and sadly, a bit more bad news to sift through with me.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I guess it's more that there's no good news yet. That's the key thing here, that we know the bad news. We know the situation they're in at London Irish. We're all waiting for this deadline that was set for them of May the 31st by the RFU, by which point the club has to prove it's viable to operate in the Premiership next season. That either means that the takeover that has been in talks for 5 months actually goes through by that deadline, or the current owners have to commit to fund the club for next year. All we know is that both of those things at the moment look unlikely. The players are still being given sort of snippets of hope. Certainly the people who talk on behalf of the consortium insist that work is going on and that they will get this over the line. But the deadline is looming large. The documentation and the due diligence that the RFU has to do has to be completed before that deadline date. So the documentation has to be in quite soon. As you say, it's in limbo. So it's not that there's more bad news. It's just that we don't have the good news that everyone wants.
And then when we look at this, you know, just from the outside, Alex, you know, do you have any guesses of what the holdup is or where this thing is stalling? Because I've heard similar from when I hear any rumblings from the London Irish side, there's still hope. And when I hear from outside or different sources, they seem to be quite adamant that it's not looking good and it's only a matter of time. So what do you make of what's going on there?
So what I hear is that there are concerns that they just don't have the funds to push this through. The man who's leading it, a former sports agent, was involved in similar talks at Saracens that ultimately didn't get over the line. And there are fears that the same thing will happen here. Now, as I say, the consortium are talking in positive tones, but they can't provide any evidence to reassure people that there's progress. On the flip side of it, the RFU first asked this consortium for information 5 months ago, and deadline after deadline has been missed, and now there's a hard stop, if you like. So what's the hold up? Well, the hold up is that what they're being asked to provide is proof of funds and other key information, such as who is going to be the named owner of London Irish. And that information has not been provided. So the only conclusion you can draw is that they don't yet have the funds in place to be able to provide that documentary evidence to the RFU so that the due diligence, the owner's test can be conducted. Now, the RFU were criticised pretty heavily for not scrutinising the owners of Worcester closely enough. So they will be doing everything they can to make sure that the people coming in to own London Irish have the interests of the club at heart and can keep the club afloat and are viable and legit businessmen with a good business plan. We've just seen Wasps last week rejected from the Championship because although they had a plan, they didn't have the funds in place. The RFU said, well, if you haven't got the investment, you can't come in. And so that's why the RFU are being really diligent about this. They have to be. But you've got to ask yourself, why, if even 5 months ago, 4 months ago, 3 months ago, if these people weren't prepared to say who they were and where their funds were, why this wasn't thrown out and everyone could move on to try and find somebody else instead of this whole thing being strung along until now? We have a hard deadline of next week, but actually the documentation needs to be in this week because it's a weekend coming up. There's a bank holiday, public holiday in the UK on Monday, deadline's Tuesday. So, like I say, there's no new bad news, just no good news.
And I guess you took the words out of my mouth a little bit. I was about to go on about, you know, when you know, the RFU and PRL bosses stepped in front of, you know, members of parliament and stuff. And there was the quote, I think you're asleep at the wheel, thrown. Was it Bill Sweeney from the RFU? And when you look at this, is this another case of that it's been allowed to go too far? It has fallen through the cracks on the RFU's watch? Or is this a symptom of the lack of oversight, the broken system that potentially, hopefully, will be fixed sooner, but wasn't able to be fixed with a stroke of a pen at the time and place where the vulnerabilities were shown with the falls of Worcester?
I feel it's more a symptom of a broken system that is being fixed. So if you think 5 months ago, when the RFU first requested information from the consortium, they were also in the middle of dealing with Wasps and Worcester and the collapse of those clubs and what that would mean. I suspect they didn't have the bandwidth to put the pressure on at that point. And also, they were there in the background requesting this information, but it's not they aren't the ones who are trying to buy and sell the club. They just have to approve the owner. It wasn't for them at that point to step in and end any deal, but it's got to the point where they have made this deadline, set this deadline, because of the impact on the on the game beyond London Irish. So although the new season is a couple of months away, they need to know who's going to be in the Championship. They need to know who's going to be in the Premiership. They need to build in time for the players and coaches and backroom employees of London Irish and try and help them find new employment if this doesn't work. So they are definitely much more hands-on, the RFU and Premiership Rugby, much more hands-on in trying to find a solution here than they were with Wasps and Worcester. It's a definite lesson that's been learned, a reaction to the failings that happened before. In an ideal world, pressure would have been put on earlier to stop this dragging out. But if you think back 5 months, they were in the crisis dealing with the collapse of two clubs. So I feel that they're doing the right thing now, but the fact it's come this far is a symptom of a broken system, which, as I said, is being fixed. There is a financial oversight panel being introduced by Premiership Rugby with, we understand, some very high-powered, highly respected non-execs sitting on it to oversee the league, to have sight of the club's books, because that helps them shape how they structure the whole season, how they structure the league going forward. So I think if this was to happen next year, it would be handled differently. But it's happening now, and the RFU are having to be strict about things now because of the lessons they've learned from Wasps and Worcester.
And then if we look back at, say, proof of funds and the big issue here, do you know if the RFU's at least been in meetings with the group? They've spoken to them. They might not have the paperwork, the accreditation that says, here are proof of funds. Here's an exact breakdown of this group and who's going to have what stake in it, and this will be the title owner. We don't have that. But from my understanding, they've been trying to be proactive of getting this deal done with PRL. There must be some sort of meetings or some sort of point of contact for this consortium with those entities to at least give them some form of hope to put a deadline on it and not scrap it or make a decision straight away.
Well, you would hope so. And unfortunately, I can't confirm if those meetings have actually happened, because the consortium are refusing to comment on anything. They're refusing to provide really any evidence or any narrative that would give people genuine hope that this could happen. Now, I know that the Wasp situation, which broke on last Friday when I was over in Dublin for the European Cup final, that they will not be allowed back into the Championship. Now, potential investors of Wasps did meet the RFU and said to the RFU, we are here to commit money to Wasps, but we can't commit before we know what the environment looks like. What's the Championship going to look like? Will there be promotion and relegation at any point in the foreseeable future? What's the central funding model going to look like? Now, rugby in England isn't in a position to answer those questions. So we were in with Wasps in a kind of a catch-22 situation where the investors had...
Hey, Fidelity. What's it cost to invest with the Fidelity app?
Start with as little as $1 with no account fees or trade commissions on U.S. stocks and ETFs.
That's music to my ears.
I can only talk.
Investing involves risk, including risk of loss. Zero account fees apply to retail brokerage accounts only. $0 commission applies to online U.S. equity trades and ETFs and retail Fidelity accounts. Sell order assessment fee not included. Some account types and securities excluded. Details at fidelity.com/commissions. Fidelity Brokerage Services LLC, member NYSE, SIPC.
Want to make mom's day? Get to your Nordstrom Rack now and score amazing deals for Mother's Day, which is Sunday, May 12th. Find tons of gifts from only $30 at Nordstrom Rack. Fragrance, jewelry, luxury bags, activewear, beauty, and more. Save on Kate Spade New York, Stuart Weitzman, and Ted Baker London. Great brands, great prices. So shop your Nordstrom Rack store today and treat mom to the good stuff from just $30.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Had met the RFU and said, we're here, we're willing to get involved, but we need answers. But the RFU and Premiership Rugby don't yet have those answers for the season 2024 onwards. And so it stalled, and the RFU had to say, well, you're not coming in because you don't have the committed funds. Now, I know that that happened with Wasps. I don't know that that's happened with London Irish, and every indication I've had suggests that it hasn't because of the tone of frustration coming out of Twickenham, that they've missed all of these deadlines. That indicates to me that there hasn't even been that same level of communication.
So it's really this consortium and Mick / upper echelons, Power Day, potentially London Irish, that are actually in direct contact. And is this just a business standoff negotiation? Is that where we're potentially at? They're not going to give the information or relieve pressure on London Irish until they get what they want out of the negotiation. That's why it's going down to the deadline. Then you've got, London Irish / through their ownership group, which is trying to, enforce deadlines, hold them to some sort of point. The issue we had with the unpaid wages and the delayed and the potential money sent. Is this just a standoff negotiation and we're kind of from the outside seeing this and not 100% sure what's going on?
Well, I think it could be. And if that is the case, if it's a genuine negotiation, then at some point you'd find a solution for it. And I think what the RFU have hoped for with this deadline is that it puts the pressure on for an agreement to be reached. I don't feel, from what we understand, there's no value in this consortium waiting for London Irish to go bust, to go into administration and then come back, because they've missed the deadline to be part of the league next season. So my understanding is that if the club gets bought out of administration, they have to wait a year before they can re-enter the league system. So I don't feel there's any value in waiting and then trying to rescue the club. If they want a viable club for the next 12 months, then they need to get the deal done by next Tuesday. I think that's what the RFU are hopeful, that by setting this deadline with their intervention, it will trigger some movement. And we're being told that the consortium are, quotes, working around the clock and confident of making some big strides in the next day or two. Well, they have to, because from what I'm hearing, confidence that this deal is going to be done among officials is down as low as 10%. There's no sign of white smoke coming out of London Irish. As someone said to me, there's an awful lot to get done and no sign of it ever actually getting done. So as the clock ticks on, the hope diminishes. But until we reach that deadline and we're absolutely sure that no deal's done, we have to retain some sense of positivity that there is an element of truth in all the work heading in the right direction. But like I said, I've said to you before on the pod, it's really hard to believe that because there's nothing to back it up. So we can hope, but we have no evidence.
The only other little rumblings I've heard at times is there's been some whispers that if some form of agreement can be reached even before May 30th, that there is a potential bit of wiggle room of extending that deadline a bit longer to allow this thing to get over the line. Have you heard any confirmation on that, or heard that as well?
I've not heard confirmation on it, because I think for good reason the RFU are trying to play this hard, like have this as a hard deadline. But I do think that if the documentation is in and it means the thing has to slip a few days, then I cannot believe that there wouldn't be that wriggle room available to, because the season is a long way off, and provided there's enough progress made that can give confidence that the club will be a viable premiership operation next year, I think they'd be cutting off their nose to spite their face if they stuck to the deadline, even if there was enough evidence to show that this was progressing. I think they'd need a lot of evidence to show it was progressing. They'd need everything in place, and maybe they give a couple of days for this outside agency to complete the due diligence on the owners. I can see them allowing that to happen, but I think they would need much more than they've got on their desk right now for that to happen. They want a swift solution here because of the impact it has on the rest of the league structure. They need to work out the Championship, which at one point was going to have Wasps and Worcester in it, will now have neither of those clubs in it. There'll be no team relegated, obviously, from the Prem. So they're trying to work out the structure all the way down the pyramid. So they need to know.
And when you look at, say, proof of funds or what this group has to show, like how much money do, like what are the thresholds of qualification to pass this? Like how much money do you need to show in a bank account or show access to get this across the line?
Well, the figures that we know are that the club, whoever buys a club, has to take on the existing debts of the club. Now, most of those debts are owed to Mick Crosson and Powerday, who have loaned London Irish money close to 20 to 30 million is owed to them. Now, that you would imagine would be part of the takeover deal. But London Irish will, you know, I'm not certain exactly how much they lose each year, but the average across the Premiership is £4 million a year. So you'd have to, in order to keep the club viable and afloat for a season, bearing in mind that they don't own their own stadium, so their revenue generating opportunities are way down on every other Premiership club, they need to be able to cover losses of £4 million across the year, approximately. The average, the wage bill's £500,000 a month, so that has to be covered. So you're looking at people who need, in order to take on London Irish, they already need to accept debts of £30 million and the prospect of losing another £4 million approximately, guesstimate there, but around £4 million over the course of the season. So that's the, you know, and so what they need by proof of funds, it's also, I think, really a business plan. How do they propose to manage the club? What's their vision for growing the club? All of those elements, which are really important and sort of form part of the test of a club when they're trying to get promoted. What's their commercial value? What's their vision? What's their academy? All of those elements too will form part of this. But proof of funds will, at its base level, will be, can they afford to keep the club afloat for the foreseeable future? And that will have to be what they can guarantee to the RFU.
And then the follow-up question from that is based on, say, the other scenario of positive news for London Irish comes through, that Mick confirms he will fund the club for one more year. What does he need to do or provide RFU PRL to do that? Or is it more just a verbal, as he's already an existing owner, already in the club, does he just have to say, no, we'll go again and Powerday will write more loans off to the losses of London Irish?
Yeah, so Powerday, which is the company that Mick Crosson founded about 45 years ago, they stated publicly in their mission statement in 2021 that they would, as a company, support London Irish. So I don't think he doesn't need to go through any due diligence. He just needs to commit to continue to supporting the club for the next year in the way that he has done for the last decade or two. And that would be enough. The thing is, all the indications are that he's reached the end of the road. He wants out now. He's ploughed a lot of money into this club. A year ago, he said he'd give the club away for a pound because of the debts. Now, that was a sort of a flippant comment, but that indicated he was ready to walk last year. And he's now spent 5 months working with this consortium trying to get a takeover. I'm sure, I don't know Mick Crosson, I'm sure the very last thing he wants is for the club to go under. But the indications we're getting is that he's reached the end of the road. And we're hearing it around the Premiership, what they call investor fatigue. Because of the losses that I mentioned, the new chief exec and chairman of Premiership Rugby, who I think are going to do really good things for the league, they're having to convince the owners that there's a brighter future, that there's a turnaround that can happen, that they can attract a better television deal, grow the commercial value of the league. But at the moment, it's not a competition that people are that keen to invest in, as we're seeing with London Irish. So, long-winded way to answer your question. Mick Crosson is already an approved owner. So long as he agrees to continue underwriting the club, then that would be enough. The fear is that the word is that he's not that keen to do that anymore.
And then just a question on, you just said, say, you guesstimated 20 million of the 30 million debt is potentially owed to Powerday through loans as such. I'm assuming there's a decent bit of interest attached to those loans. Otherwise, I don't know how you could justify continually writing off that much money. If this sale goes through, will those loans be paid back? Will the interest be paid back? Will it just be owed to Mick? Say the club falls through, God forbid, will that money just be written off as Power Day as losses? Like, how does it all work from that side of the structure? Because I'm assuming the complicated nature of that has got to be one of the stumbling blocks to why this isn't getting done.
Yeah, I think there's a complicated ownership structure at the club. The ins and outs of what's core to the negotiations and who owes what, none of us are privy to, but you can assume that the ownership of their training centre, as we've discussed before, is not straightforward. The way that the club has been supported and run by Power Day makes it a complex deal to be done. Who ends up being owed what? We're going to have to wait on that, or maybe we'll have to engage a proper financial investigative journalist, because I sit in front of company accounts and my eyes start to roll. I can't quite comprehend those figures.
No, and that's fair, mate. I'm just asking based on just the numbers and the math, just how does it work? You know, why would anyone want to be a premiership owner write off all this debt?
I can tell you that the RFU will be insistent. So if you look at Wasps and you look at Worcester, they place a huge premium on protecting rugby creditors. So anyone who is owed money within the rugby family will have to receive their money. That's like a prerequisite for any deal going through. And it's why Worcester were trying to not come back as Worcester, and they didn't want to pay the rugby creditors of Worcester, which we believed were up to £8 million. They didn't want to pay it. And one of the issues at Wasps, of course, is that they needed funding and investment to pay back rugby creditors. So whatever happens, it's the rugby creditors are given priority within RFU rules if London Irish are to continue.
Understood. And then, so this is the last bit of the saga that I wanted to talk about, is just the silence across both sides and the effect it's probably having on players, staff, but also fans as well. If you search London Irish on Twitter, there's so many worried or distressed fans just wanting to know some answers or some updates or something about what's going on, who seem to be getting more and more disheartened by the silence. I'm sure staff and players have some internal chat and updates, but my understanding is as well is that's very limited and frustrating. Like, how long or how much can this go on without a comment? Do you foresee it getting to the end of the week, no update and still no comment until the 30th of May? Or do you expect something to happen this week, announcement or update or something?
I don't expect anyone to say anything until there's something concrete to say. And that has just, as you say, allowed this silence to, this void, this information void to be created. And I know that I've heard the same. The players have had meetings. They've been given some positive assurances, but then they're never supported with anything. And so they don't believe them anymore. And why would they? The players are now discussing their next steps with the RPA, the players' union. The conversations now are around what happens after this deadline. The assumption is that this deadline won't be reached, won't be met. So therefore, the players are saying, if London Irish are suspended from the Premiership on May the 31st or June the 1st, the deadline's the 31st, but they could give them 24 hours to assess the situation before a decision. So let's say they're suspended on June the 1st. The players are trying to find out what that means for them. I think at the moment, if they get their money, their salaries, then they're under contract. The assumption is if London Irish are suspended, then the salaries won't get paid, and then they have to submit these breach of contract letters, which give the company or the club 2 weeks to pay the money before they're free to leave. What the players want is that if London Irish are suspended, they want to be able to leave the club the very next day and start new contracts with new clubs straight away.
Seems very reasonable to me.
Absolutely. And And, you know, we know that the rules technically say you can't go and negotiate a new contract while you're under contract. You can't look for another club somewhere else. But the circumstances are that players are doing that. They're lining up provisional deals elsewhere because they don't have confidence that this is going to go over the line. And part of that is the complete lack of communication. And so all we have are some positive noises that are not supported by any concrete words or concrete evidence. And then everyone, you know, and then it creates doubt. And I talk to people and you talk to people, and all we hear back are senior executives in the game expressing doubts that this is going to happen. Now, if I was working on the other side of the communications fence in PR, I would be filling that void with, if there was something material to say, I'd be saying it. I'd be outlining my business plan, explaining why I want to buy London Irish. Bring people with you on that journey and say, you know, and then people have hope and confidence. Unfortunately, you know, you talk to players, they're sitting there at home now in their off season, they might be on holiday, waking up each morning, hoping for an email or a message with some information. They are in the dark. They're sitting there waiting, hoping for something to come. It's not how I would want to be, you know, and if this deal goes through and I worked at London Irish, I would immediately be cynical and dubious about the people who were my employers because of what they just put everyone through for all this time.
That's what's been, I think, the tough part is that there'd been talk for, I think, internally for so long that this group was going to be introduced. They were going to meet the players. There's going to be all this stuff. Now that hasn't happened. And if I'm trying to give the most positive outlook if I could give of what's going on, it's basically a Mexican standoff, you know, chicken, two cars going to a head. There's obviously some stumbling blocks. Both are trying to force the other's hand. And it's really the players and the staff and the fans that have to sit there in silence with almost like eyes closed, not even knowing who's going to win or what's going on until either there's a crash or someone pulls out and they actually get the deal done.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about those people caught in the middle. People caught in the middle are the people who play for, work for, coach at, or support the club. You know, they're the people whose livelihoods or whose passion, hobby is on the line, and they have no information other than what we try and dig out for them. And unfortunately, everything we dig out is negative because there is we're not finding out anything concrete that's positive, and that's it's heartbreaking for those people involved.
It's heartbreaking, Matt. I feel for them. I know a lot of them personally. There's so many good people that have committed like so much above and beyond to that club, from just passion to time to their whole lives to being obsessed to sacrifices with family. It really is a great club. Its fan base is incredible. You know, it's got so much cool history. I got so many fond memories. I saw some, you know, stuff on Twitter today talking about your favourite London Irish memories and stuff. And, you know, for me, I think to that 2009 semi-final going to Harlequins as the fourth seed and beating them, nilling them at home was probably one of the best things. Mike Capp boxing up Danny Kerr on the floor. Like, doesn't get much better than that in my mind in the London Irish shirt.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It's a club that's so, like, tightly sewn into the tapestry of English rugby, and you think of the players who've played there, and what they could achieve if they get it right. The thing is, it feels they're just a long way off it. They need a stadium, they need a base, and right now they need backers. But it, you know, it would be, yeah, I mean, it would be unthinkable for them to not be around. But we would have said that last summer. We'd have said that about Wasps and Worcester Warriors. So. Really sad.
Alex, thanks so much for your time and your insight and talking this through with me. It's obviously, you know, quite, for me, a serious topic that needs to be covered. It would be devastating to see this go through, fall through the net and finish negatively. So for me, I feel sort of a obligation to cover it because I think it's really relevant. I've been surprised at how little coverage it's gotten elsewhere at times. I know there's been a lot of good stories with rugby, with Champions Cup final that was incredible to a Prem final that's lining up with tons of stories that I know you've been covering on. And we haven't even gotten into that in 30 minutes. But I do feel like, you know, someone has to give this story justice. There's going to be loads of London Irish fans that are wondering what's going on. And I do feel some solace that this is actually a place where some of them can come listen and at least get some insight or discussion or some idea of what potentially could be going on, because at the moment, as we've said, they're very much in the dark. So thanks so much for that, mate. And good luck this week covering this story, but also the Prem final.
Yeah, thank you. And you're right. Dublin, the Champions Cup final was awesome. I mean, it was one of the best rugby occasions, matches I've ever been to. I just loved it. I loved everything about the occasion and the game. Just sensational, just an awesome showcase for what this game can be. And I hope that we'll have another one on Saturday at Twickenham with Saracens and Sale and Owen Farrell v George Ford and Ben Earl v Tom Curry and all those storylines that are going to unfold. This is the time of year where rugby shows itself at its best. The sun's shining, the pitches are dry, the best teams are going against each other for silverware. It's exhilarating stuff on the field. And you're right. We want the balance to be there. We've got to cover the stories. The news is the news, but man, we love these big events, these showcase matches, the best players, because they deliver what all that's great about rugby and that we can all love. And I thought that the Champions Cup final, there was no better example than that. And let's hope for another humdinger at Twickenham in the Prem final on Saturday.
Always a pleasure to have Alex on, but that is a wrap on this week's show. Thank you so much for all the support this season. As we're starting to wind down, we'll do one more pod after the Premiership final, and that will be a wrap on this season's Scrum Down. Thanks to everyone for all the support along the way. I hope you enjoyed the episode. Thanks to our guests, Ross Hamilton and Alex. Great insight on all the topics that we have covered. Appreciate the support to the pod. Fingers crossed for London Irish this week that we get some positive news and development. The best thing that could happen to me is, as this pod is out on Thursday, you guys are saying it doesn't actually mean anything because we've had the announcement, the groups have agreed, and everything's going ahead. That's what we're all hoping for. But realistically, the situation has to be covered. We've covered it inside and out. I hope you guys enjoyed it, and hopefully we'll get some positive news, but TBD on that front. But that's a wrap on this week's show. Please keep favoriting, liking, sharing, retweeting, telling your friends, spreading the word of the pod. We appreciate the support here, myself and NBC Sports. But for all of us, that's a wrap, and we'll see you again next week.
Don't just ride the index, seek to outperform it with Fidelity Active ETFs. Learn more at fidelity.com/active ETFs. Before investing in any exchange-traded fund, you should consider its investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Contact Fidelity for a prospectus, an offering circular, or if available, a summary prospectus containing this information. Read it carefully. While active ETFs offer the potential to outperform an index, these products may more significantly trail an index as compared with passive ETFs. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, member NYSE, SIPC.
Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.